This is my journey, inspired one story at a time. A library of leaders was created. It began as a journey to learn. As time went on, it began to grow. All it needed was a platform, and this podcast was created to listen, to inspire, to share. I am a storyteller, and this is my journey. Welcome to another episode of Profiles in Leadership. I'm your host, Steve Anderson, and today we have a very interesting guest in Errol Dobler. You talk about a high-octane career. This guy really has done it all, it seems. He's a Naval Academy graduate. He has been a Navy SEAL. He has been an FBI agent. And now he's a leadership coach for businesses. It hasn't been all smooth sailing, though. There have been some skids along the way, and he tells stories about in his Naval Academy experience that he didn't take it serious enough and almost got pushed out a couple times, but he persevered and was able to reach his dreams to be a Navy SEAL. It's an incredible story, really, and I hope you enjoy it. We just talk a lot about how the experiences that he's had in the Naval Academy, in the Navy SEALs as an FBI agent, that those experiences and those lessons that he learned there, the principles involved, are very very transferable to business. So what we can learn from him is immense, and it's just interesting how you can take those extreme conditions and show how those things can really work in the business world. He's also a disciple, or a follower, I should say, of Wim Hof, which is an extreme discipline that looks at cold therapy. In other words, exposing your body to extreme cold, and also breathing techniques to get control of your mind and your body, and he'll explain it better than I can, but it's just a really interesting piece of the puzzle. So enjoy this episode. It's very, very interesting. He's done a lot and has shared a lot with us. A great speaker, and I really was fortunate to get him on the show. And so without further ado, let's just jump right into it. Errol, welcome to the program. I'm really looking forward to our discussion today.
Thanks, Steve. I really appreciate you having me. I'm always appreciative when I go on these shows and you give me your time. So hopefully we're going to give the audience something special today.
Okay, that's excellent. Now, looking at your resume, it's just so impressive. It's, going from Naval Academy to Navy SEAL to FBI agent to business coach and leader, it's just really impressive. But I also realized that it wasn't all smooth sailing. So in relation to the Naval Academy, what challenges did you have there, and then how did you get through them?
Well, yeah, so again, and the resume stuff is great, and I'm super proud of a lot of it. But you know what you bring up was the challenges along the way, and I don't ever really want to come across as somebody who says just do exactly what I do and you'll be great. You know, it's more along the lines of here's the things that happened that I did in spite of my success. So at the Naval Academy, for example, I was a lazy student, to put it mildly. And, I didn't embrace the great education that I had, but more importantly, I was more a bit of a rebellious midshipman, right? The Naval Academy, for anybody who's listening and doesn't know, it's a military school, it's a university, it's a 4-year educational degree, but when you leave there, you get commissioned into the Navy. So it's very also heavily military based. So you get kind of indoctrinated into that military lifestyle. And, I found my way to breaking a few rules and was what's called head restrictee a few times, which means the person with the most demerits, they get to be in charge of all the other rule breakers, which is a little backwards. It was just kind of a combination of those things that, and a lot of immaturity on my part, a lot of insecurities that I wasn't aware of. So overcompensating for certain things. And then again, just a general rebellious attitude. I found myself in a little bit or a lot of trouble on numerous occasions. And likewise with the academics, there was something inside me somewhere that was saying, well, don't sit down and study 4 hours a night like you should. And I don't even know what that reason was. I mean, I know now. But it was some of those emotional challenges as a young man that I didn't have my arms around that started me off on the wrong foot in a couple places there.
So why didn't they give up on you? And why did you not give up on yourself? That's such a rigorous program. I would think there's a very limited room for error there.
The dichotomy is striking, right? I found myself pushing the envelope, knowing what the consequences are, but certainly fighting to stay. And I think ultimately, I did like being in the Navy. I did like the structure. I loved the military, and I wanted to be a SEAL. So ultimately, that was a big part of it. The other part is I didn't want to be a failure. So again, the dichotomy is striking, around my behavior and my desires. But I will say that each time there was somebody different that came forward and said, Errol's worth saving. He moves in the right direction when you point out to him, what he's doing wrong and what he's going to be held accountable for going forward. And he cares. And I think so. There was always somebody that said, yeah, he's being a little silly, but he's worth saving. He's going to be a great leader. And we're not going to give up on him because he's not giving up on himself. He's just got some maturity issues that we're going to help him work through. And they did. So, each time it was just that kind of one person stepping forward and reading me and reading the situation and saying, let's keep him moving forward because he's going to be worth it. So I've never forgotten those people.
Yeah, that's great. I think we all need mentors and coaches and people to kind of lift us up sometimes when we're, not heading on the straight path. So that's awesome. So do you still stay in contact with some of those people that helped you get through?
Well, gosh, unfortunately, no. That was because, that was about 30 years ago. So some of them may not be around anymore. Just in that amount of time, you lose touch. But I certainly remember who they are. And they're in my spirit. They're with me in spirit all the time, for sure.
Okay, so now you get out of the Naval Academy and you decide you want to be a SEAL, which we all know is extreme in the sense of discipline and pushing your physical and mental limits to the max.
Yep.
So how do you get into the program and how do you do in that program? Looking back at your Naval Academy experience, were you more mature then or were you able to handle it or did you have to learn some hard lessons as well?
Once again, we had to learn some hard lessons. So at the Naval Academy, when you are about to, graduate, they have what's called service selection night. And they've got all the service availabilities up on the board and it goes by class rank and you pick, what's up there. I wanted to be a SEAL, but there was only like 7 or 8 SEAL billets available. And that's not a lot. And I was, towards the bottom of the class rank, right? Because I didn't take my studies as seriously as I should have. So I paid for that. So I was standing at the board almost in tears with there was just ships up there. And I didn't want to be what's called a surface warfare officer. And, one of these people came up to me. He was a senior officer. He was a captain, an 06 in the Navy. And, he just kind of asked me what's on your mind, what's going on. And I told him, he says, all right, then you want to pick that ship. And I said, why? And it was an oiler. And I said, why? And he goes, because that ship is out to sea all the time. And I said, but didn't you hear me? I don't want to be on a ship out to sea. He goes, yeah, I heard you. You want to be a SEAL. But the only way for you to become a SEAL is to get out on a ship, get your qualifications as fast as you can to separate yourself from the rest of the competition, because there will be competition, and then ask for the lateral transfer over. He said, that's the only way you're going to separate yourself is to get out there, get out to sea as fast and as often as possible and get your qualifications. That guy saved my career, right? Because I never would have gone that route. Now, that said, I did not necessarily want to be on the ship. So again, I still had some maturity issues to work out, right? I still had, I was still falling into some of those same traps about, well, I don't really want to be here anyway, but I have to be here. And I'm going to just now kind of do some of these rebellious things. Once again, a couple of times some of the officers would come over and say, hey, Errol, I don't get it. You're doing this so amazing. And then you went and did this. Right. And it was never anything really professional. It was more, on a personal level. So, you know, and I would always take that advice. And you know, when I went to my commanding officer and I finally told him, hey, I want to be a SEAL and I want to transfer, you get very nervous because they'll either support you or they won't. And it was another great lesson for me. He said, you know, Errol, I figured you didn't want to be on the ship, not because you haven't done a great job. You have done a great job. But now I understand why there was some of that reticence in you. And yes, you have my support, because if you want to stay in the Navy, I want to support you in the Navy. And we're going to really push you through these last couple months to get your qualifications as fast as possible. I mean, and again, another great learning point for me, right? It was just as a young man, feeling like I was having these missteps, but watching people look at the bigger picture, the bigger person, the bigger goal, and then still supporting me through it. So I got lucky and I did get, you know, that was able to laterally transfer. The competition was huge. And, but that initial officer's advice is what separated me. My goodness, Errol, you went out to sea, you got your qualifications in 8 short months, twice as fast as anybody. You know, we're going to take one person, you're it. Congratulations. So, you know, then we transferred over to the SEAL community, and there I am, exactly where I want to be.
So you get, I believe that's in San Diego, right? Yeah, that training.
That's right.
And so you get to San Diego and you go in, and what's your mental state at that point? I mean, are you just scared to death? Are you pumped? Are you kind of cocky because you're one of the few that's gotten this chance? What's going through your head?
Well, once again, many emotions. It is from the day that, you know, when I was a senior in the Naval Academy, that's when you've got to really start making decisions about what you want, maybe more along junior year. And that was it. I had become obsessed. I wanted to be a SEAL. And then when I didn't get it, then I became obsessed. Every time I didn't want to do something on that ship, I just thought, I have to do this because there's someplace I want to be. Right. So it was just, when you talk about really having a vision, right, there's something you want. There will be nothing that stands in your way. Everything I did was geared towards that. So when I got there, there was a sense of relief. There was a sense of euphoria. There was some cockiness, right? Because here I am. I knew I'd make it, which gets zapped out of you very quickly once you start going through the training. But there was so much joy, and then anticipation of what to come. I don't think there was a ton of fear, not because it wasn't fear worthy, but because I knew, and this is something, you know, I tell people, I wasn't going to quit, right? And this is before I even knew one thing going in. And that opens up your mind to be able to say things like, you know, fear isn't going to stop me, right? That's not going to be my limiter, because I'm not going to quit. But I might be anxious about some things that I don't know about. I might be insecure that during a time of sleep deprivation, I'm going to get a little nervous because I hope that I don't quit without even realizing it because I'm so sleep deprived. So there's that trepidation, but I didn't have the fear. And people who make it through BUDS, I think typically don't have the fear, because the thing there you would be afraid of is quitting. And if you just already decided this is what I'm going to do no matter what, well, that kind of leaves your mind, and it allows you to focus on what you can do to make it through as opposed to what's going to limit you.
Yeah, the odds are just ridiculous. I mean, how many people start that and how few finish? And I read somewhere that the ones who make it are the ones that finally bridge that gap between caring more about themselves or caring more about their teammates than about themselves. Is that true? Is that kind of the way it works?
Well, it is. And the attrition rate is 70%. Now that varies. It's not always 70% across the board, because if you go to BUDS training, you know, SEAL training is called BUDS, Basic Underwater Demolition SEAL. If you go in the winter, it's going to be a higher attrition rate because, you know, it's the winter. It's cold. It gets cold in San Diego, and the water certainly gets cold. So my class started with a couple of hundred people, and we ended Hell Week, which is like week 4 or 5, with 10. So that bumps up those numbers, right?
So, yeah, absolutely.
So, but to your point, especially for me as an officer. So right before Hell Week, that's when you, if there's any fear, that's where it is. And it's more the fear of the unknown, because you never have experienced anything like that in your life. It's 5 days long. They told us at the end, we got a total of about 2 hours of sleep, not per night, total. And you know, there's going to be sleep deprivation. You know, there's going to be extreme cold for extended periods of time. And you don't have anything to draw from, right? So that's where there's the fear of the unknown. I hope that I have it in me to make this, but I don't know that I do, right? So that's the only trepidation. So as I was sitting, and it's funny, these stories just come back to me. As I was sitting in my room before we headed out for the first, you know, to meet up to go out for the first night of Hell Week, you know, I had that fear. And I said, what am I going to do? I can't have this fear going into Hell Week, because you'll quit. Anybody who does this quits. And that's when I went to, you know, I'm a leader. I'm an officer, by definition, a leader. So the second that I start feeling something that's about me and I have this personal fear or trepidation, I have to look outward and say, who can I help? Who can I take care of? Okay, take it off of me and look at everybody else, because that's what I'm supposed to be doing anyway. Right. And that's what I did. And that saved me. I left my room full of confidence. Right. Like, wait a second. This is what I should have been thinking the whole time anyway. Thank goodness it hit me. So I was always good. Anytime I started to feel sorry for myself or this is really bad for me, I just said, stop, look around. Somebody else is feeling the same thing. Go help them. And
that's such a great lesson. Yeah. I mean, that's easily transferable to business, right? I mean, you know, instead of making it about you, if you can make it about your team or making it about your people, you know, it definitely changes everything.
Well, 100%. And it has to come from the awareness, right? So I never would have done that if I wasn't aware of A, my emotions, and B, what my personal culture would have been based on those emotions, right? It would have been to retreat, think about myself. So as I was aware, and I talk about that in the book, in my process of leadership, it starts with an awareness of how we feel and what our culture is, which is basically the things we do, right? So I was able to employ that almost without even knowing it as a young man, and then that saved me. So in the business world, it's the same thing, right? If you're feeling something, we need to be aware of what that thing we're feeling is, right? That thing in our gut. Right? Okay, what's happening right now? Let me see what's happening. What am I doing based on this emotion? Well, gosh, if I'm doing it and I'm feeling it, it's pretty certain somebody else is, right? Especially if you're a leader of a team. There's going to be a general feeling of angst if there's something to be anxious about. You won't be the only one feeling it. And that's where you start looking outward. So it's absolutely applicable everywhere.
Yeah. And so let's talk a little bit about the book here. You have published a book called The Process, Art, and Science of Leadership, which tell us a little bit about why you wrote the book and why that came out.
Well, so when I started my leadership consulting firm, so I left the FBI after 13 years out of some frustration with the FBI leadership. But I loved being a special agent for the FBI. It was just the environment. There were some things I disagreed with, and I discussed that, right? I talk about things like environment. Creating the leader's job, in my mind, is to not get people to love their job. It's to get them to love the environment that they're in, right? And you do that by creating a predictability around the environment. So as I left the FBI and I said, well, I'm going to start, if I believe this much in leadership, let this be my world. Let me share my lessons. So you have to sit down and you really have to stroke out what do you believe, and does it make sense, and can you transfer it to a lot of different areas? Is it applicable, and can I put it into a very bite-sized piece of information? And the answer was yes, I could. So as I started to, you know, have clients and work with organizations and individuals, you know, and work out the kinks to my process, you know, you eventually say, now it's time. I'm ready to share this. I think people will get a lot out of this. I think it makes sense and anybody can apply it. Okay, now that's the kiss of death, right? They tell you when you write a book, who's your audience? It can't be for everybody. So, you know, I identify, and that's by and large true. But, you know, I identify who generally the audience will be. But what's happened, the response to the book has been exactly what I wanted it to be. I have housewives and single mothers coming and telling me, I read your book and it's helped me here, right? Executives, right? High-level executive CEOs. Errol, it was awesome. I didn't think I was going to be able to apply it in all these places, right? Mid-level managers who say it's helped me both coming home and at work. So it is having the effect I want. I believe it's applicable everywhere. And it basically just lays out the process or the five elements that I believe are important that you'll find everywhere. Emotional awareness and recognition, because emotions drive our actions. To cultural awareness and recognition, because culture is made up of the things we do, not the labels we put on them, right? So the emotions drive the actions. Those actions make up our culture. Once we go through that awareness and we start to see what we do and based on how we feel, and sometimes it could be a really hard place to go, then we go to guidelines for behavior. Then we start deciding how we want to behave. We see what we do and we say, boy, if I just behave this way, things would get better. So now we focus on one or two behaviors as a leader, right? That sets the bedrock for the leadership, awareness, and then decisions on how we want to behave. And then the next element is a planning process, right? Because in the end, we as leaders are judged on mission accomplishment. So all I did was bring over the planning process from the SEAL teams. I watered it down and modified it a little bit and said, if you follow the elements of this planning process, you'll succeed, right? And then we talk about, in the end, the resistance. Why this makes so much sense. This makes so much sense. Why sometimes won't you follow it? Okay. So inside each one of those elements of the process, based on what I described, it will be a little unique to each person, right? My emotions and challenges will be different than yours, but we'll agree that we have to have emotional awareness, right? The behavioral guidelines that I need to get better as a leader will be different than yours, but we'll all agree that we need to establish behavioral guidelines for ourselves and for our teams. How I employ the planning process will be different than how you do it, but we all agree we need to have that plan, that planning process. So that's the art. And then what I came to realize when I was about three quarters of the way through the book, that my process literally follows the pathway that the brain uses to rewire itself. And then I started doing the research and I said, this is awesome. Because I can now say, here's some scientific research based on emotions and what that does to the wiring of your brain and culture, basically what you do, what that does. And then when you make decisions on how you want to behave, how that starts to change it and how the brain understands your commitment to that decision when you have a plan, right? You start executing something. That's how I just call it the process, art, and science of leadership, because there's some things I think that will never change. Inside of those things that will never change will be very unique to each person and team. And then if you don't believe where I come from on this, which is fine, I only ask anybody to take it for a test drive, but I can point you to the science, at least to get you to say, all right, I'll give it a try. I'll give it a test drive. So that's kind of a long-winded answer on the book and where it came from. But yeah, that's pretty much it.
Well, I think it's fascinating, just fascinating how the science, the more and more we learn about the brain and how it works and how it's just so interesting to read about and dive into. So I'm glad you went there, because I think that really adds to the credibility of some of the things that you just laid out. So,
well, you know, and again, it's really important for leaders to know, and anybody really, right, to know that that science exists. Because they wonder why it's so hard to change. Why is it so hard to make behavioral change? Well, the science gives us the answer. And so what I'll tell people who I'm working with is, now that you know this, this is what we call the resistance. And now you know the resistance is really based on a neurochemical makeup, a neurochemical addiction to some behaviors and emotions. And then because we keep repeating it, our brain gets wired tighter and tighter that way. But now that you know that's why, and now that you know that there is a way to rewire it, give yourself some grace, right? Give yourself some patience as you're having the courage to make these changes. And that really helps people a lot. It's good to know this, the down and dirty of the science, but what I've found for people, it's more important to know there's a reason why I'm doing this. There's a reason why this is so hard. It's not just me being lazy or unable, right? There's some science behind it.
Well, it's certainly a process, that's for sure.
That's for sure.
So let's back up a little bit and go back. So now you've gone through the Navy SEAL training, you graduate, you're a Navy SEAL. Was it what you hoped it would be? Was it that exciting adrenaline, you know, just exactly what I wanted, or were you surprised?
It was what I wanted. You know, so I was the SEAL in the 1990s, so there wasn't a whole lot of work to go around in the 90s. So, but that doesn't mean we trained any less, right? We weren't just sitting around, you know, trying to figure it out. If anything, we overtrained and overanalyzed. And it was a nice transition from the world, our Vietnam, you know, forefathers. They were just leaving the teams kind of as I came in and just passing those final lessons on. But it was everything I hoped it would be. I didn't have a ton of expectations for how much combat I would see or anything like that. I was just so excited to be there and be a part of it. And ironically enough, when I was on deployment, we were training for an operation and I got injured. And it was one of the few operations we would have seen. And I ended up getting medically discharged. And it came on the heels of some personal struggles I was going through. I was in a failing marriage and all these things. So there was kind of this perfect storm of awfulness, around that time, but it's still, even in hindsight. So I got out way back in 1999, in hindsight, it was still, you know, the greatest professional time of my life. I loved it. And I loved everything about it and everything it stood for. And the majority of the leadership lessons that I've learned and the things I try to impart on people, it comes from the SEAL teams. So yeah, it was, yeah. For me, it was great.
And you struggled a little bit with that identity piece gone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, talk about that a little bit, about how that's dangerous to identify with something so strongly that if it's taken away, you're in trouble.
Yeah, it really is. And I'm certainly not the only person, you know, who goes through this. And in the business world, right, who goes through this? CEOs who leave their company. You know, they really have a hard time with that transition. This is who I am. This is what I've identified. This is who I'll always be. And then all of a sudden it gets taken away from you. And it was a struggle for me. And I had to start really, and it was like most things that happen that you don't want to happen. Like most trials, it depends on how you handle it. Okay. And I got lucky and just really was very reflective on that time. You know, where were the things that I did wrong in the SEAL teams? You know, I left under certainly a cloud of my own doing. You know, it was nobody else's fault, and I didn't really do anything terribly wrong. It was just, it's not how I wanted to leave, right? So I left and didn't leave the way I wanted to leave, and now here I am, I'm going to be a copier salesman. So I was able to really reflect on all of that, and what I came out of it was, you have to be careful with what you identify yourself with. If you're identifying yourself with something that can be taken away, you need to change it. And so what does that mean? So I use a very, very hard in your face example with people, mostly just to get their attention, but it's somewhat true. So as parents, right? My sister died when she was only 39 years old. That was a while ago. But I use that as an example, right? My parents were rightly devastated. And I don't think they've ever fully recovered from it, as most parents who lose a child don't fully recover from it. So what point am I making? What do you identify yourself with? And I'll say, look, my mother and father, for example, may identify themselves as the parent to their daughter, right? That's their identity. But she was taken away from them. And now they'll still always say, well, that's still who we are, but she's not here anymore. So what can you identify yourself with that can't be taken away? Doesn't mean you're going to mourn that loss anymore. But, and I don't know the answer to the question, right? I'm not saying that there's this easy answer. What I'm saying is, and I had that conversation with my dad before he died, and he agreed. You know, he's like, Errol, it's no right answer, but we were very tied to that identity, and that made it even harder to get past it, you know, to really celebrate something about our daughter that we lost rather than this continuous mourning behind it. And I use that again, it's a very hard example to use. And some people won't agree with that example, but, you know, I think it brings the point home. So what are some things? Well, you can be a leader and never have that be taken away, right? You can be a person of compassion and love, and somebody can't take that away from you. What do you identify with, right? So I really had to, I struggled with that and had to find some things to say, what is a behavior? What is that thing that I can identify with that nobody can take away from me, but that I can bring everywhere, that I can bring to my life with new friends that I'm making, that I can bring to my family, that I can bring now as a husband and a father, right? There's got to be some traits that I identify with that nobody can take away from me that will benefit every aspect of my life. And that's kind of what I base the guidelines for behavior portion of my process on. I don't know. Does that make sense? Or did I go down a rabbit hole?
No, it makes sense. And I think what you're saying, and I agree with, is that if you identify with, as you said, something that can be taken away from you, that's dangerous.
But
who you are, your values, your morals, your, you know, you said leadership, things like that, you can take that anywhere. And those are things that you should latch on to and not some title or position or something that, as you said, can be taken away
from you. If you have a value, if you have a behavioral guideline, you can take that away from yourself, but nobody else can, because you can be that person always, regardless of the circumstance. So, yeah.
That's interesting. So now I have to tell you, it's got to be a stretch to come out of being a Navy SEAL to be a copier salesman. So that's got to be tough, but somehow you do that and then you make the transition and you end up in the FBI. So tell us about that side of the journey.
Yeah, but what I'd like to hit on that copier salesman thing, because that's where I got the, again, I got into a very introspective mode then, thankfully, and that was the place where I learned about the importance of environment, okay? And because I loved that job, being a copier salesman, not because I loved copiers. I couldn't have cared less, right? But the environment that the gentleman I worked for created was awesome. Why was it awesome? Not because we went out and had happy hours and things like that. We did, but that's not what made it awesome. Everything about what happened at work was predictable. He made it clear what he was going to hold us accountable to, and that made life very easy. There was behaviors that he expected from everybody on his team, and there was a process, a business process, that he expected you to follow. Simple as that. If you behave in these ways and you follow this process, your life will be easy. It made it simple. Okay. And because it made it simple, it was easy to execute. We had great success. Okay. And then we were able to do all these fun things that people like. We got together, our team got together after work for happy hours and on weekends and became really close friends. We didn't have a great team that outperformed every other team in the country, quite frankly, the world, because it was in an international company. Because we did happy hour. We did happy hour because we came from a very predictable environment where it was clear what we were held accountable to. And that has always stuck with me, right? So I tell people, so now to transition into the FBI, okay, where I ended up leaving, even though I loved the work of an FBI agent, I didn't like the environment. So I'll tell people, leaders I talk to, how do I get people to love their job? And my answer to them is, why do you care? And of course, I get that initial reaction like, oh, I thought you were a leadership coach. How dare you say, how do I care? And my point to them is, you don't have any control over somebody's motivation for taking that job, right? Like my boss as a copier salesman didn't have any control over my motivation. I took a job because I needed a job. So I went and sold copiers, okay? So he didn't have any control over my motivation. So what I tell people is, you have control over the environment. If you make an environment that people love, they'll love coming to work. Okay, it doesn't matter if they love their actual job, because the need for them to have a job, earn a living, and support their family trumps love of work. Okay, and I know that's not always a popular thing to say, but I think it's true. Okay, But yeah. as a leader, no. you can get past that. Create an environment with predictability. What kind of predictability? Emotional predictability, behavioral guideline predictability, predictability around planning and execution, right? They will love the environment. And then those things start to happen. I love the environment. That I, because now I know how to treat people, I can expect those behaviors to be consistent. And now all of a sudden, I kind of enjoy the people I'm working with. And now all of a sudden, because I enjoy the people I'm working with, we're taking a certain amount of pride in this thing we're doing, in our widget, which under normal circumstances, we wouldn't care about. But now we do, right? So I think we've got it backwards sometimes. Leaders want to...
Yeah, and I think you... Yeah, I was just going to say, you use the word environment, but culture could also be substituted for that. So it's the culture, it's the environment, it's what people are immersed in. And then if you have a great culture, you don't have to be a motivator because the culture itself just brings people along.
Well, that's exactly right. And the culture, once again, it, by my definition, and I think the general definition, because sometimes we stretch that word a little bit, the culture is made up of the things you do. Okay, that's it, right? So if you can say we have a culture of excellence, I'm not telling you not to put that label on your culture. Okay, but what I am saying is my next question to you will be, great, tell me what you do that creates excellence specifically, right? Now, if you truly have a culture of excellence, you'll be able to rattle off three or four things that your team or company does that makes you excellent. Good, then you have a culture of excellence. It's really a culture of these things you do. So again, that's, you know, that's what makes a culture so good. Accountability. Right? Well, you can't hold someone accountable if they don't know what they're supposed to be accountable to. So what do we make them accountable to? We make them accountable to behaviors. Okay. So then now that they know that, we can say, well, wait a second. What didn't you understand about what we do here? Right. These are the things we do. This is how we do business. That's our culture. That's the environment. Exactly.
So you had that culture, it sounds like, in the copier sales company that you were with. And so now you go to the FBI. You say you love the job. So tell us a little bit about what you did as an FBI agent and why you loved it.
Yeah.
But then also tell us what was the leadership gap that caused you to leave something you loved?
Yeah, it was. So I worked primarily international terrorism out of the New York office. I was, you know, Manhattan, New York. And I traveled all around the world. So I was in the FBI for 13 years, and I did that for 9 of my 13 years in New York City. And, you know, I joined the FBI in 03, and that was at the height of the, you know, the war on terror, right? The FBI was still getting its feet under them to be a proactive intelligence/law enforcement organization. So I was right in the middle of that. You know, recruiting sources, infiltrating terrorist networks, and it was exciting, and it was important. At least I thought it was, and it was rewarding because I was part of several operations that truly saved lives, that stopped terrorist attacks and put terrorists away, and that's a good feeling, right? It's everything you hope it will be. Then I moved on to violent street gangs, which is just as rewarding, right? There is, when we talk about, you know, the Crips and the Bloods and street gangs like that, you know, I was in those communities and I was recruiting sources inside those communities. And what you find is the communities are devastated by a few people. The overwhelming majority in the neighborhoods that are crime ridden and gang affiliated, you know, I think the percentage is small, right? Of actual gang members. The rest of the people are simply held hostage by that. And they're afraid to help for obvious reasons, but to be able to go in, gain the trust of somebody from that environment and have them provide you necessary information to start dismantling the very, you know, gangs that just literally and figuratively kill neighborhoods and communities, it's rewarding. So again, I just loved it. I loved recruiting sources. I loved getting people on the inside to help us. And I loved having an impact. It was all the same things I took from the SEAL teams, right? You know, the behaviors that you do, the planning that you do. There was just nothing about it that I didn't love. I didn't even mind writing the reports, right? Because the reports were what, you know, the reports are what made the cases. That said, how do you know? Again, I'm always very careful that I don't come off like I'm just taking gratuitous shots at the FBI. Because I caveat it with this: some of the best leaders I've ever met were in the FBI. The problem is, they were the outliers. Okay, in the SEAL teams, the expectation of great leadership was the norm. In the FBI, the expectation of bad leadership was the norm, and that is not a minority opinion. I'm pretty sure if you ask a bunch of FBI agents that they're going to say the same thing. So what made it that way? Well, not sure. I think that there is a lot of misplaced ego in law enforcement in a lot of places. You know, that's what happens, I think, sometimes when you get that authority. And you don't handle it with the respect it deserves. And when we have misplaced ego, and then you get to be in charge of a squad, and all of a sudden somebody may have a different idea than you or do things differently than you do. I saw a lot of envy and jealousy, a lot of resentment that perhaps maybe I had an idea that would work better, or that I was maybe more willing to take chances, and some of those chances panned out, and those weren't chances that maybe the person I was reporting to would take. It was basically around pettiness. And then when there's that type of pettiness, it comes to poor behavior, innuendo around the way people do work gets treated as fact. Sometimes straight lying gets treated as fact. There's a disrespect around ideas that are thrown out there. So when you throw an idea out, you could a lot of times count on people snickering or rolling their eyes or talking about you behind their back. So it just was a multitude of little things. And the problem is that in each one of those instances that I saw it, it was overwhelmingly a few people who acted that way. So why couldn't they be overcome? Well, they couldn't be overcome because in every case, the leader either was blind to it or participated in it. And that just goes to the point of the leader sets the tone no matter what. So even if there's just a couple of bad apples among 15 in the squad who are acting that way, if the leader accepts that behavior, then that's the behavior. That's the culture, right? That's what you do. Because if the leader lets it go, that's it. There's no fighting it. So that's kind of in a nutshell the frustrations I saw from the leadership in the FBI.
Yeah, and how do you know, you've been through such a gamut of leadership styles. I mean, I would think that you know, the Naval Academy and the Navy SEAL is more of a command and control style, and yet you've seen what the opposite of that is in the copier salesman and position you were in, and now you're in the FBI. And so how do you think that some things you learned in command and control can help you with business leaders going forward? Because I think in the business world, command and control is thought to be not the way to go.
Well, yeah. So, you know, that command and control is going to mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people. So I'll break it down a little bit from my experience and what I think it means. You know, there's a military philosophy, and I don't know that the military came up with it, but it's called decentralized command. And basically, that's instilling initiative and autonomy in your people, right? That's really all it comes down to. If every decision goes through one funnel to one person, you're just not going to get anything done, right? People are just going to be robots. They are going to wait to be told what to do. And they're not going to take any initiative. They're just going to wait. And therefore, things don't get done. And then the leaders are going to complain that my people don't do anything and I have to tell them to do everything. And that's, they don't even realize that they've created that monster. So when we say initiative and autonomy and decentralized command, well, how do we do that? What does that mean? And what does that do for our people? Well, that's part of the process, right? And in that part of the process, if we say to ourselves, our behavior is, for example, decentralized command, right? We use a military vernacular. Okay, well, what does that mean? What do we do? Well, now we use the planning process, right? We've got our behavior, we've got the planning process. So when I say as leaders, okay, as the leader, I have to identify the situation, why we are doing what we're doing, and the mission. Okay, that's my job as a leader. And then I say to my people, here's the situation, set of circumstances dictating a need for action, and here's our mission. I want you to come back and tell me how we're going to do it. Through actions, through contingencies, through command, meaning who's in charge of what, and come back and tell me. I have just done it, right? I have just decentralized my decision-making process. I can't let those people start acting on their plan till I hear it. Once I hear it and challenge it in certain ways, now everybody knows what they're accountable to because the mission is clearly laid out and who's in charge of that. Each action is clearly laid out and who's in charge of each action, when it's going to be completed. Now, who will be accountable to what is clearly laid out, and where you have authority to make decisions is clearly laid out. Okay, that's it. It's as simple as that. If as a leader, and then in your communications plan, you are getting frequent and targeted updates so you can make small adjustments that you see from a 30,000 foot view, but you're still letting the people do their job as they planned it. That's it. That's decentralized command. That is giving people initiative and autonomy to do their jobs. Okay. And it really becomes as simple as that. So where did we see that? We see that in the SEAL teams, right? Because I can't be in the field, okay, on an operation and then not do something that might require action until I get authority from four levels above me. That's ridiculous. Okay, so we saw it easily there. Okay, we saw it. I saw it in the copier sales, right? Here's the plan. We have a process. You're free to make decisions inside of this. Okay, because I know what you're going to do. And, you know, I challenged your plan. In the FBI, sometimes yes, sometimes no. Those outliers, those great leaders that I talked about, that's how they operated. Errol, this is the case you want to do. Good. Here's the mission you want. Here's your target that you're going after. Tell me your overall plan. Makes sense. I'm for it. I'd like to hear an update every other day on that. Otherwise, you're free to make decisions inside that. Okay. When it didn't happen, it was, Errol, you can't do anything out there until you call me back and let me know. Now, I worked very aggressive operations in the FBI. I worked undercover operations where I was directing, you know, the undercover that was moving certain places, and we were on security and keeping them safe and controlling communications. And then something would happen. And if I made a decision in the field, which I did many times and they worked out, I would still get reprimanded coming back to the, you know, to my boss. You should have called me and told me what was happening. And I would have told you that was okay. And I said, well, by then it might've been too late. Okay, somebody might have gotten hurt, or we might have lost the opportunity. And therein lies now the friction around poor leadership. So I don't know, does that make sense to you? Yeah. Do you see it the same way?
Yeah, no, exactly. And I think that, the word command and control, kind of indicates one person's yelling and screaming and make all the decisions and everyone else has to follow.
Right.
But I think you've laid out pretty well that it's more like, a more command and control way of looking at things and setting up a structure for those people then to have some autonomy within that structure to go forward and do what needs to get done.
That's right. I mean, the big boss needs to know what's happening, right? He or she needs to know generally what's happening, but that should happen up front. Okay. And then the targeted updates come right now. We just can't funnel those decisions. And that's the killer, right? It's just a killer when people just can't make decisions on their own.
Right. And then I think in the business world, what makes it work better then is when you have that team, that high level team involved in the decision making, involved in the process and understanding why we're doing what we're doing and designing it. They have better buy-in when they're a part of it as opposed to something just coming down from up above and this is what we're going to do. So I think that's an important piece too.
You're exactly right. And the challenge that the business world faces, and especially the bigger organizations, right? The multinationals. And I run into this a lot, is the dotted lines of authority, right? I don't necessarily, because I'll say, look, we've got to make a plan here. Okay. And we've got to include these people. And they'll say, well, Errol, but I don't have authority over that person. They're dotted line to me. And I finally had to start imploring the higher level leaders to throw out the company organizational chart when it came to specific tasks or missions, if you will, for lack of a better term, projects. And the question, you know, I got was, well, why? We have to maintain that discipline. And I said, right, but here's the problem you're running into. Nobody's doing anything because everybody's being so kind because they're dotted line. I said, why don't we all agree that inside each task or mission or project that we create a new organizational chart? Okay, so that way, when we put one person in charge, that person gets to make the final decision when there's pushback. So the dotted lines no longer matter in the huge hierarchy. They matter. They only matter in the huge hierarchy. They don't matter for mission accomplishment for this thing. And if everybody can get behind that, we're going to have a lot less stagnation in our decision-making process, because that's what stops the decision-making. Two people who think they're in charge and nobody knows who's in charge, and then everybody's just trying to go to the person where they'll get the answer they want, and then there's conflict. So if we start removing, right, if we start making a hierarchy, a chain of command for each mission, well, that's going to decentralize our command and make things happen a lot faster. And I don't know if you've seen that in the big organizations or not. That's my experience about why they bog down.
No, I think that's an insightful view of that for sure. So now that you're working with business clients, what are your clients looking for, and what are the biggest challenges they have?
I hear accountability a lot, right? And it's basically going to be a summation of, you know, what you've given me the opportunity that I'm super appreciative to explain. Accountability. Errol, how do I hold them accountable? You know, they're just not taking initiative, right? Accountability and initiative. And the answers are exactly what I said. Well, accountability. What are you holding them accountable to? Well, what do you mean? Okay, well, there we go. If you don't know, how can you expect them to be accountable to something? Well, they should just know that, right? I hear that a lot. And I say, well, why should they just know that? Why would you hope or assume they should know something when you could just make it clear? So then we've got to start hacking out, what are you going to hold them accountable to? Let's make it clear. And then you've got to tell them that on a consistent basis. Because if you just tell them once, it's not going to cut it, right? So accountability, that's one of the big things. And then the initiative and autonomy. My people don't take initiative. They just sit around and wait for me to do things. Well, you just heard that explanation. Do you have a plan? Do you have a planning process? Okay. And are you following that planning process? Right? Are you setting the situation, letting them know why we're doing what we're doing? Because a lot of times organizations are doing things they don't need to be doing, for one. Okay. And then are you giving them the mission? And then are you asking them for the plan, the rest of the plan, how they're going to execute it? Because that in and of itself takes care of the initiative problem. Here's what else it does. The final thing that I hear most is silos, right? How do we break down silos? Right. Well, inside our planning process is something called communication. Who are you going to communicate with? When are you going to communicate with them? By what method, right? Phone, voicemail, video conference. How long are you going to talk to them and about what, okay? And what I'll tell people is breaking down silos is not some huge thing. If what you're doing, if your project can affect a different business unit, positively or negatively or some other way in between, then they need to be part of your communications plan, right? If they're the group that you're going to hand off what you're doing to when you're done, you need to be communicating with them on a regular basis to keep them updated. You've just broken the silos, okay? If something goes wrong in your plan that's negatively going to affect this business unit, you need to let them know what you're doing. And you need to keep them up to date, okay? What I hear back from that is, well, yeah, but I try that and they don't get back to me. Or they'll never get back to me. My answer is, so what? You're doing your part in breaking down the silo, okay? That's all you can do. And if you're consistent with that and you're communicating in good faith about how what you're doing might affect that other unit, they'll get on board, right? It's just a new behavior that's going to take a little while for them to get used to. So those are the three big ones.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just another way to say it is very clear expectations, mm-hmm. defining the why,
yeah.
and then communicate and overly over communicate.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So let's, as we start to wind down here a little bit, you know, you talk about extremes. You know, I look at your life and then there were a lot of extremes in that. And now you're kind of a Wim Hof guy.
Oh, yeah.
Which you talk about extremes. So, you know, just explain that in a nutshell to our listeners as to what that is and how do you think that helps you become a better leader and why you think that, you know, that's something to look at and think about.
Well, Wim Hof is for lack of a better term, a Dutch extreme athlete. And basically what he's done is he has shown the scientific community, everything he does now is backed by science. He has shown the scientific community that we actually have the ability to manipulate our autonomic nervous system, right? Our innate immune system through breathing, cold exposure, and mindset. Okay, and they did studies on him abound. And they're literally rewriting the science books because of it. Okay, so his breathing technique is very unique. It's a very aggressive breathing technique that we use for a specific purpose to manipulate our autonomic nervous system, to activate voluntarily our fight and flight, our sympathetic nervous system, and then conversely activate our rest and digest, our parasympathetic nervous system. What that does is it resets our nervous system, flushes our body full of the inflammation caused by stress and other bad habits that we have, which now we know is the cause to almost every major disease, cancer, Alzheimer's, depression, arthritis comes from inflammation. So he's taught us how to flush our bodies full of that from that inflammation, which in turn strengthens our immune system, right? So stress relief and strengthened immune system in this day and age, do we need anything more, right? And we do that through the breathing technique and we do it through cold exposure, okay? And a certain mindset. Now, cold exposure, what does that mean? For me, it means ice baths. I take ice baths every day. For somebody just listening, it can mean a cold shower. Okay, and we talk about how we respond. Now, how does it make us a better leader? Well, when I became a Wim Hof Method instructor, right, I did it kind of for myself. I thought it was super cool and I liked it. And then I was like, wait a second. This is an amazing tool to practice the elements of my leadership process. Right. So when I say my first element, Steve, is emotional awareness and recognition. Well, how do we practice that? Well, I can tell you one thing. If you're standing in front of an ice bath, you're going to have an emotion. Okay. And if our intention when we go into that ice bath or even the cold shower is to say, I'm going to practice focusing on my emotion. There's the ice. There's the cold shower. You can't hide from it. I feel nervous. I feel afraid. I feel insecure. I feel like this is stupid. I feel like this is beneath me. It doesn't matter what you feel. What we get at is it's an intellectual tool to practice the art of emotional awareness and recognition. You go down the list, cultural awareness and recognition. What do? I promise you, before if you look at what you do before you get in a cold, in an ice bath or a cold shower, right? Are you walking around? Kind of looking for something else to do, procrastinating, right? Are you skipping it altogether? Okay, when you get in, what are you doing? Are you hooting and hollering and making a big show of it? Or are you trying to be calm and focused and get your breath? You're going to find that the way you behave, what your culture is, it amidst that that cold exposure mirrors what you do in stress in your everyday life. It's fascinating. Then again, we decide guidelines for behavior. How do we want to behave? I want to be calm. I want to be focused. I want to be in the moment, right? I want to see the bigger picture. Great. Now I can practice that. That's my intention going into the ice bath because that's what I want to do as a leader in the outside amidst the chaos. So that's Wim Hof in a nutshell, right? So, you know, and I do that with my clients for weekends and I run just straight Wim Hof seminars, but you can always go to the Wim Hof site to check it out, or you can go to my site, leader193.com, and I've got all my stuff up there. But that's it in a nutshell, and it's pretty awesome. So if you haven't looked into it, you know, definitely do.
It's fascinating. It's fascinating for sure. Well, Errol, at this point of the program, I usually ask all my guests a common question, and that common question is, leave us with a pearl of wisdom today. So in relation to leadership, What is your pearl of wisdom you can leave us with today?
Emotions. Everything starts with emotions. Work hard today to be aware of how you feel in every circumstance, from minute to minute, hour to hour, what your emotion is and how you're acting on it. Right? And especially in today's day and age, with the political climate that we've got, I feel that everybody's just acting on emotion. Pay attention to that, right? You get into that conversation, understand how it's making you feel, but then make a decision. How do I want to act based on this? I don't want to yell and scream, right? I don't want to be that person, right? I want to be a different person. So that would be what I would leave everybody with. Focus, just start there. Focus on your emotion and see where that gets you, because it's going to bring you in a nice direction, I promise.
Well, I think it's a good awareness, because emotions are with us everywhere all the time, and being able to control them and use them to a positive advantage is definitely something to consider on a regular basis, for sure.
Absolutely.
So tell us a little bit, to finish off here, your book again is called The Process, Art, and Science of Leadership. I assume you can get that anywhere on Amazon and other places?
Yeah, you can go to my website, leader193.com, click there, but ultimately it's going to bring you to Amazon. So that's where it's available. The audio book, we're just about done recording it. So we hope that that'll be out in the next month or so. But yeah, leader193.com or Amazon, The Process, Art, and Science of Leadership.
Okay. Well, Errol, thank you so much. This has been very insightful. Your life has been extremely interesting, and it's been a journey for sure, and still going strong. So I appreciate all you're providing to leaders around the world, and hope to run into you again somewhere down the line.
Well, thank you, Stephen. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you and your audience. It truly means a lot to me, and I hope we gave them what they came for.
Okay. Thanks so much, and have a good rest of your day.
You too.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Profiles in Leadership. To listen to all my interviews, subscribe to Profiles in Leadership with Steve Anderson on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, and many other popular podcast platforms. Some of these interviews are on video, and you can search YouTube for Profiles in Leadership with Steve Anderson. You can also access the entire library of interviews on my website, orange.coaching.com, and that is orange.coaching.com, and go to the Media Center and click on Podcasts or Video Gallery. You can also enter the website from pilpodcast.com.